Hi. I just want to thank the Middle East Working Group and all the organizations that sponsored this talk for having us here. It's my first time meeting both Nurit and Cindy, but I am honored to be on a panel with them. Let me just tell you a little bit about myself. My parents were born and raised in a village north of Ramallah, and they came to the U.S. in the late 60s. And we were born and raised in Chicago. When I was 13 years old, my parents decided, like many middle-class Palestinian families in the U.S., that we needed a taste of our culture, religion, their heritage. And they took us to live in the occupied territories in the West Bank, of course, not knowing that the first intifada would break out. I actually did not want to go. I really knew so little about Palestine. I had heard the words occupation, but I mean, it was not something that was forced down our throats, even though it was a big part of my parents' life and heritage. So in 1986, we moved to Palestine, and that was my introduction, basically. So those words, military occupation, which sounds so abstract to so many people, I can kind of understand why people wouldn't even be able to envision what it's really like, because I certainly couldn't. In fact, when I came back from Palestine after 2 years of high school education there, I didn't talk about anything I experienced for a long time, because I simply didn't have the words for it. I didn't have the vocabulary for it. And it was actually just too difficult to think about. And it was only later that I actually found the words to describe it. So I'm going to try to tell you a little bit of, I mean, probably most of you already know what military occupation actually means for the Palestinians who live in it. We've heard of occupation, but the majority of the time we hear it, we actually hear it from the perspectives of the occupiers. And it, of course, is a completely different experience for the people who are experiencing complete eradication of their rights. There is a structure of Israeli occupation that is basically meant to strip Palestinians of their civil rights, of their ability to develop, of their economic rights. It's practically impossible to have an economically viable business state because of all the checkpoints. So Israel actually does this through several ways. One is settlements. Another is checkpoints and roadblocks. Another is the permit system. Another is the wall. Another is the dual legal system, one for the Israeli settlers and one for the Palestinians living in the occupied territories. In the West Bank alone, there are over 190 Israeli settlements. They're built on confiscated Palestinian land, and Palestinians whose land they're built on cannot move into them. But many times the settlements actually take the agricultural land of the Palestinian villages. For example, my village, much of the agricultural, it was an agricultural village, but now you hardly see any young men of working age who live there because they simply cannot survive economically, and they try to provide for their families by leaving. So a lot of times if you look in the streets, it's just very young people or very old people or women mothers. But what happens with the settlements is that they're built on Palestinian land, and then the Palestinian villages and towns and cities are no longer able to expand and develop because the settlements not only have their own built-up area, but they reserve huge spaces of land, of Palestinian land, so that they themselves can develop. So I remember when I was there as a teenager, one of the things that most disturbed me about the settlements, besides seeing them in settlers in the streets all the time with guns, is that many times our water in the village would be shut off, and the settlement right above us called Shiloh had, you know, just a mess. Their water was never shut off. They had you know, plenty of water to water things, for swimming pools, all of that kind of stuff. And our electricity would also be off and turned off. Theirs would not be turned off. That's how, you know, you kind of saw the difference. In the streets, we had to have different license plates, and in fact, color license plates, and that's still the situation there. Palestinians have to have blue license plates, and Israelis have yellow license plates so that Palestinians can easily be distinguished on the roads. And the road system is, of course, another way to control the population and constantly exert your power and let Palestinians know who's in control. In the West Bank alone, there are ranging from, at any given time, 500 to, figures I've seen most often, 757 roadblocks and checkpoints throughout the West Bank. And I know that because of the media portrayal of this conflict, a lot of people assume that the checkpoints and roadblocks are often located on the border with Israel. But in fact, the vast majority of these roadblocks and checkpoints are located in between Palestinian towns and villages, separating Palestinians from each other, from their schools, from their neighbors, from their families. And the checkpoints and roadblocks are a huge source of humiliation for Palestinians. I can tell you stories. I'll just tell you one. One time, because in my village, the taxi stopped running around 4:30, and I was working late in Ramallah, and I needed to go to my sister's house in Jerusalem. So I tried to pick up a cab in Ramallah. Well, I did pick up a cab in Ramallah, and I went to Jerusalem. The thing is, my visa had expired. Because I'm Palestinian, I'm treated as a tourist because I'm Palestinian-American, and I only get 3 months to stay. So every 3 months, I had to go and renew my visa to be able to live there for this amount of time. So when I got to the checkpoint, I showed the soldiers my paper saying that my visa was being renewed. Not that it was being considered for renewal, but that it was in fact being renewed. And the soldier who stopped me at the checkpoint said, no, you just can't pass. I mean, it's that random. It's basically whim. And I actually seriously needed to get to Jerusalem to find a place to sleep that night. And I told him, you know, I have to go there because my sister's house is there. This is a permit, which, of course, the permit system itself is a bureaucratic way of maintaining Israel's occupation, a very detailed one, a really insidious way to control the population. And so anyway, he refused. So I saw the soldier got distracted by another Palestinian he saw and wanted to harass. So I went and talked to another one and said, you know, this guy is not letting me through. I have a right to go through, and this is not even a permanent border anyway, and I need to get to sleep. And so that soldier was actually about to say yes, and then the first one came along and just had to assert his power and said, I said no, you've got to go back. And I was, of course, really upset, and I said, you know what, well, I mean, you can't be both soldier and jury and judge, and I'm going to walk towards Jerusalem. And I started to walk, and then I heard yells behind me, and I looked back, and they were kneeling, a group of them, kneeling and pointing their guns, they're called M16s, at me. And, you know, I really didn't have a doubt in my mind that they would actually shoot me. And they would probably say I was, a terrorist, or I was threatening them or something like that. So I walked back. And as I walked back from the checkpoint towards Ramallah, you know, just a little way, they all started laughing at me because I had to go back. I mean, that's a simple story. I'm a patient person. So, I mean, I just said, well, I actually found another way to get to Jerusalem, of course. I just went around the hills. I didn't want them to win. But, I mean, what kind of bothers me a little bit more is that I saw them doing this to Palestinian men all the time. And, it's just really, really terrible to see that on the roads all the time with these men sitting on the sides and blindfolded and, you know, just never, like, a constant state of insecurity, permanent state of insecurity, never knowing when a soldier will have a whim to, you know, try to humiliate you, send you back when you need to do something urgent in another town. But anyway, the thing is, the roadblocks and checkpoints actually serve to ghettoize the Palestinian territories, to ghettoize the West Bank. I mean, Gaza itself is completely surrounded. I mean, people cannot, it's been a sealed open-air prison for so long now, I mean, with just terrible consequences for the population there, huge poverty levels, major unemployment, I mean, creating a simmering pot, you know, just waiting for something to happen. But in the West Bank, there are hundreds of these, like I said, and they serve to ghettoize and isolate Palestinians from each other. Then there's the wall, the Israeli wall, which a lot of people, again, because our media doesn't tend to do its own investigative work, tend to believe that it actually does separate Palestinians and Israelis, like the Israeli government claims. But in fact, the wall does not separate Palestinians from Israelis. It separates Palestinians from Palestinians. It separates Palestinians from their homes, from their agricultural land, from their neighbors, from their schools, from their hospitals. 80% of the wall is actually projected to be built deep inside the West Bank, not on the border. And in fact, it's meant that, it's either 65% to 75% of Palestinian communities that live in proximity to the wall are now poor. They now live under the poverty level. And in one village in the north of the West Bank, which was traditionally an agricultural village, Israel basically took the agricultural land and the water resources, which the northern West Bank is pretty famous for, and it placed them on the Israeli side of the wall. So now the farmers on the north can't actually access their fields, to work their fields, without this extremely difficult-to-obtain permit. So at any given time, these farmers in Jayus, 65% of them cannot get a permit to access their land. And when you're all constantly trying to obtain a permit to farm your land one day here, one week there, I mean, it makes it just unviable. And so actually these farmers, the majority of them in Jayus, depended on their olive groves for subsistence. They were very self-sufficient with their agriculture. And now the majority of people in Jayus are dependent on external food aid. So, I mean, the wall is doing, and I think what Israel is actually trying to do is get the Palestinians to leave. Because if you're not able to make a living, like people in my villages did, I mean, in my village did, they left. And Israel is basically counting on the fact that these people, after a certain amount of time where they're dependent on food aid, and these are people with pride who've basically managed to have sustaining livelihoods for so long, probably won't put up with it for that long.